This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So I asked Barry, as all Jukai talks start, I asked Barry what to talk about, and he said that our Jukai talks are what another Zendo might call way-seeking talks, which I find interesting because I never heard of that, and they're talks where the student discusses how they found practice, what they're struggling with in it, and why they come back to it. And I liked that because as a resident, I've given beginner's instruction to a few people, and a handful of them, like two of them, have come back and become like dedicated. But I watch them, I'll watch them in the Zendo sit, and they're struggling with their restlessness and they don't know what to do. And I look at that and I just think to myself, how the hell did I stay through any of that? So this talk was interesting because I didn't really remember, why I came to any of this or why I stayed with it. It kind of just became this thing I did. To kind of wrap it in a precept, I found that the eighth precept kind of applied. It's normally about generosity. But according to Aitken, and I read in Rebbe Anderson too, it's also about sort of taking yourself whole, using all of your life. The Bodhidharma is a little opaque, so I'm just going to skip to the Zen peacemaker version, which I like. Using all of the ingredients of my life, this is the precept of not being stingy. And Aitken elaborates on what these ingredients are, and he includes... Because normally you'd think it's like your resources, like time, money, enthusiasm, and stuff like that. But he says it's our karma, habits, tendencies, preferences, personal history, and basically all of the particularities of my little life, which obviously includes everything, I would not want to work with. So to start at the beginning, I found practice by accident. I was leaving a grad program in biology at the time. I loved it. I loved doing research and reading papers and everything. But I didn't really feel like a grad student. And I couldn't commit to 7 years of it with that feeling. And I kept doing research with the lab after I left, but I could just never resolve the two. So I wondered what would have happened if I went to grad school for religion instead, which was my other major. In this funny bout of independence, I decided that I didn't need, a degree program or someone's permission to go investigate something. So I decided, let me look into what religious practice and experience look like in the city, and maybe I'll write about it. Maybe I'll blog about it or something. So I just started going to services all over the city. Eastern Orthodox, Lutheran, Christian, Episcopalian. Then I hit this Zen temple in Brooklyn, the Fire Lotus Temple. And I never gravitated towards Buddhism. And I studied it a bit in college, in mysticism and some other things. And it always just bored me. And I never, I would never have seen any of this coming. And I went into the temple because I wanted to see, what people were doing. And I got Buddhist instruction, and then I heard a talk by the abbot, Shugen, and, I was just completely blown away. I forgot all about my little project, and I just wanted to hear more and do more, and I can't remember what was in the talk. And I've done digging, I can't find the talk, and I don't think it matters because I went back week after week and had that same experience. I'd be in tears and do other people know about this? Like, you know, just really, you know, like, really into it. And I did find some stuff, because I was not obnoxious, but I was emailing some people some excerpts that, like, would move me. And one of the early ones I found was from Dogen. And this is not, like, I know now this is not an accurate recreation of the passage, but I'm just going to read it as I wrote it to this person. Kind speech means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the heart of compassion and offer words of loving care. Be willing to practice it for this entire life. Do not give up. World after world, life after life. You should speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby, as to someone for whom you have great care of their near and distant futures. Ponder the fact that kind speech is not just praising the merit of others, it has the power to turn the destiny of a nation. And, you know, it's very beautiful and moving and insightful. I think what really floored me was that there were all these people sitting around trying to study it and practice it, and, you know, they would come to the abbot, you know, tell us about this. And I called my boyfriend at the time and I said that, and I was like, you know, there's all these people sitting around in a room studying giving and, like, you know, what difference is, and, you know, how do we care for each other? And I just thought, you know, I want to study that. Like, that's, you know, that seems worth it. I became one of those new people that everyone hates. I would sit day and night in the Zendo, which was far from my house, and, like, you know, like 6 feet of snow, it would just be me and the residents. Eventually, I asked for an application for residency, and I moved in. I loved all of it. You know, obviously, I didn't know what I was doing, really. But I was sort of, like, sitting there and sticking with it. But while I was living there, I went through a really rough breakup. I was dating this guy for about a year and a half. At that point, he was moving to Paris to get an MBA from a business school there. It was right about when I was moving into the temple, and, you know, we were in love. We were going to try and make it work. It was kind of a significant relationship because I had been in longer relationships before that. But Barry's talked about, like, this move from a fantasy to imagination, where, like, the fantasy is sort of like your idealized version of something, but imagining it is where, like, you could see yourself doing it. And, like, this relationship was where I could see myself doing this, you know, like, husband, house, boat, kids, you know, like, all of it. I was like, you know, let's try this. And so when it ended, it was, you know, it was really unsettling. It really pulled the rug out from under me. And also because, you know, like, I timed my temple stay to this program, and a lot of life after was sort of, there were plans that had evaporated. So I was also, I felt very much like adrift or drowning. But it was how my teachers responded to this, which is why I think I stayed with Zen, or why it, so I went to the head monk, Jimon, after this happened to talk to her. You know, she sympathized and she listened, and I was hoping for some, like a bit of wisdom or something to make the pain go away, or just make it, give me perspective, you know, like, you know, it'll get better, or, you know, something. And she didn't do any of that. So I figured, like, you know, I need to prod her. So I said, you know, I guess this means I should probably sit more for the time being, you know, until things get back to normal. And she said, no. And I said, no? I feel like this is our thing. This is what we do. And she said, no. She said, you don't want sitting to become a place where you hide from your life. And I don't know why, but and for reasons I really don't understand still, like, that's when Zen became real for me. That whole, like, don't use your sitting for that. For some reason, that gave me the sense that, like, you know, like, this isn't a hobby. It's not a weekend thing. There's something more to it. But on a level I did understand, I was basically coming to her and saying, you know, what I'm feeling is wrong. Can you fix this or take it away? And she just would not go along with that, you know, in any shape or form. So she instructed me to, you know, like when I was walking throughout the day, just feel it bodily, you know, like wherever the pain is, just feel it. It was in my chest, like a hollowness, or my legs. I would be walking and then like each step would get heavier and heavier. And I have to like will myself forward. And, you know, she said, just feel it. And in sitting, you know, feel that. And I think the reason I could listen to her is because, you know, I think I mentioned this in high school, I had a panic disorder. You know, the only, not the only treatment, but the only thing you can do is learn to sit through it. So in a weird way, everything she was telling me was very familiar, where it's like, just feel the sensations. They don't mean what you think is the anxiety thing. So I think that was like enough to get me to trust her and like go along with it. And, you know, I'd be sitting on my Zabaton just like crying my eyes out. And, you know, I'd sit there. And a week later, Shugen got back from the monastery and I had to see him in Dokusan. And at that point, I was kind of dreading it because I was afraid he would say something like, there's nothing to lose and you haven't lost anything. You know, it's silly that you feel this way. Because I was sort of getting comfortable with, you know, like, I think I've lost something. And, you know, I was rehearsing this argument with him in my head on the Dokusan line. And I got in there, you know, he didn't do anything. You know, obviously, spoiler alert, he just did the same thing that Jimon did. You know, he listened, he was very concerned. You know, I cried for a while. You know, he asked questions. And, you know, I kind of said, you know, this thing that I say to Barry all the time, you know, is this okay? And he didn't look at me like I was crazy, but he was basically like, you know, you're grieving, you've lost something. You know, you're in pain, all of this, he didn't say all of this makes sense, but, you know, that was his posture, in a way. And whenever he would, like, leave for the monastery midweek, you know, we wouldn't always get to see him in Dokusan. He'd always have the attendants make sure that, like, I got in there. And, you know, like, not to check, you know, like, he wouldn't say it, but he would give me this space to, like, just, you know, cry, and, you know, I'm still thinking about this, and, like, it was kind of, you know, it was compassionate. And it sort of showed me something about how Buddhism values, you know, broken hearts versus, like, clarity or stability. Like, none of it, you know, none of what I brought him was valued differently from any of the other stuff. And it was the same thing with Jimon. Like, I was always treated as complete. But what I was going through was, like, important and, you know, important to be attended to. You know, it didn't mean that I was broken or something, but because it was there, we were kind of like, you know, look at it and feel it, basically. And I think that's important because, like, skipped, like, four pages ahead of you. Because, like, a lot of people will pay a lot of lip service to, like, taking life complete in their experience. And, like, I have no idea what they're doing in their heads on their cushions. But I do know how they treat my emotions. So whenever they were treating me as complete, it sort of reinforced the whole Buddhism thing. And in a weird way, I think it taught me how to sit. Like, the way they received my emotions, like, I kind of learned to do that when I was sitting. You know, like, I learned to just do what they did with me. Like, I would just listen to it and feel it and not value any of it differently. To bring it back to the eighth precept, you know, in a weird way, they were saying, you know, these are your assets. These are the ingredients of your life. This is what you're here for. You know, this is what you've lost. Here it is. And, you know, I don't know, I couldn't have appreciated it at the time. But I stayed, you know, I cried, and I healed, and it was a great experience. I practiced there for some time after being a resident, but I never became a student of the order. Like, I have many legitimate reasons, which I can see now, why that practice isn't a fit for me. But at the time, it was sort of a, like, a secret that, like, I didn't think I could do it, which is weird because, you know, I was already doing everything that a student would have to do. But I was like, no, you know, like, and I, no, I actually, because people would ask me, are you going to become a student? Like, no, you know, I think I'll shop around first. But like secretly, I, you know, I didn't think there was any way I could do it. I practiced by myself for a while, and then I missed sitting with a group, so I sort of found Ordinary Mind. I eventually kind of had to take up this issue of not feeling like it very early on. Because, you know, obviously I bring this to Barry constantly in Dokusan. Like, you know, is this okay? You know, like, whatever I'm feeling right now. And, you know, he would have to give me, like, 20 different versions of, I guess you're just going to have to ask yourself if this is it. Or, you know, you're just going to have to settle for an N of one. Or, you know, take yourself as the model of your experience. And, like, just hearing this again and again. And seeing him and Claire sort of helped me tiptoe towards that. It really became an issue when I became the resident, because Claire had asked me a few times, and it was that same thing again, where I'm like, there's no, you know, I can't do this. Like, I'm not, you know, it would be embarrassing for us to put me forth as someone living here. And, you know, and finally, like, you know, wanting to do it won out over fear of doing it. But I was miserable that first day because of that, like, that bit of shame. And I had this dream, and I dreamed that I was going to visit an old friend who was the abbot of a monastery. And we went into his Dokusan room, and we drank sake and got really drunk and told stories and fell asleep. And when I woke up in the dream, this is fuzzy, he was either dead or gone. And all his stuff was there on his cushion, and there was a note that said, I'm gone now, please take care of the monks. And in the dream, this is very vivid, it's very weird. It's very weird to have like a thought process in a dream. And I thought to myself in the dream, there's no way I can do this. Like, I'm not enlightened. They've all been doing this way longer than me. It's ludicrous that I would do this. And I remember the monks like waking up, and I'm like, he's not here. So like I decided that like, you know, maybe it was enough that like, you know, I'll prevent the roof from leaking, I'll keep the monks fed, I'll protect them and take care of them, and like I'm not it, but maybe that's okay. Maybe I can just do this. And I talked to Claire about this with the Jukai stuff, because I put Jukai off for a year. And I told Claire, you know, I don't feel like a Zen person or a Zen student or even a resident. And and she laughed and she said, oh, I always feel like that. I was like, you know, meaning she always, you know, she always feels like not the thing. And I was like, oh, and it was funny because I think I whispered it to her, you know, like the Buddha or Dogen would hear, you know, like, I'm not it. Claire's like, yeah, me neither. And it was, you know, it's like little things like that. It's the same thing like from the temple where your teachers provide this paradigmatic, you know, this posture. You know, it's not even what they say. It's just, and I think in some way, I picked that up. And Barry gave this talk where it kind of helped me articulate it. He was talking about why Christian monks and Zen monks live the way they do. And he was saying they usually try and justify it, and the Christian ones will say, well, our monasteries are engines of prayer for God. And the Zen folk will say, you know, we're generating merit, or, you know, we're saving all sentient beings. And he said they should just cop up to the fact that they like living this way. And, you know, like, it's a nice way to live. And I had this moment of, you know, holy shit, yeah, I enjoy this. I really like this. You know, this makes me happy. And it sort of clarified this tug between self-doubt, you know, like not being able to look at that in the mirror of my experience of Zen, and loving it. And like these two things are just like, and normally, you know, like self-doubt, this thing that I wouldn't even be aware of as there, you know, it's just that this means something's wrong. You know, I don't feel like a graduate student. I must not be one. There's something wrong. But Zen, you know, I love it enough that I'm like, you know, hang on, you know, like, let's take a look. And yeah, I think I just loved it too much to easily abandon it. And I don't know where the hell I am in this. this is that dualism that Barry's always talking about, of like saying, that's me. And Aitken has this nice thing where he says, when our delusions and attachments get in the way, we are dualistic in our sparing and sharing, and we cannot testify to the presentation of a flower. And that's the dualism of, I don't want to say that's me. And the flower is the self-doubt. You know, that's the bit that I'm being stingy with and not... And back in the temple, like my grief, like these are the bits of my life I'm stingy with. I need to add back to these roles. And, I can say now that like I've been practicing Zen for something like 5 years, and I don't feel like a Zen student. And that is what being a Zen student feels like. And it's horribly disappointing, but, that's here we are. but when I do like really let myself have that self-doubt, I feel satisfied with my life pretty much. That's nice. It's some of it takes a lot of work like that, and some of it doesn't. I mentioned this to Barry. Last night, before work practice, Claire said to me, how's Tangario going? And I said, yeah, it's fine. It's kind of boring. And a few years ago, I never would have been able to say that to a teacher. Like, I would never have been able to admit that I was bored, because that's not something that Zen people experience. You know, if you're bored, you're not practicing. You know, you're not... You know, every molecule of the air is not colliding with your... You know, like, that's boring too, quite frankly. But, and I had... You know, it didn't occur to me until I said it to her. And it was nice. You know, it's nice to have my boredom back and my self-doubt. And, this is what you get. Not abandoning these pieces when they present themselves. And, you know, like the anxiety lesson, there is a feeling there, but it doesn't mean what I think. And just, don't freak out so quickly. One part of the Jukai ceremony was mostly filled with anxiety. So it's kind of a blur of like, don't pass out. And like, one thing that I didn't write about this, but like one thing that like meant a lot to me is the Dharma name, Christopher. Because, in Christian mythology, it was this giant who would carry people to the other shore of a river when they needed to cross. And, one day some Jesus figure is like a baby or something like that needed a ride across, and he took him. And there's a little drama in the middle with the kid being too heavy, but, he made it. And on the other side, he said, I give you the name Christopher, now do this. Help people get to the other side. And I like that idea of tending to travelers, kind of like in the background, supporting their practice. And, that makes me happy. So thank you for that opportunity.